I also want to welcome everyone to this continuation of the theme of the distortions of mind. And it's when I start talking about the distortions of mind, there's a little more weight on the psychology and the psychological aspects of Dharma. As I've often mentioned, we don't deny the psychological implications of our lives at all. We just don't stop and rest there for the final chapter and keep continuing to move through, which is perhaps the difference between a psychological frame of reference and a spiritual one. However, much of the pain of the sense of me, the sense of self, rests in the psychological way we hold ourselves in terms of our image and our story, etc. So we have to pass through, move through, and see how to understand that storyline and to ask critical questions of it, which allow us to continue the movement of our journey and not arrest in that dimension of being. So my fear is, if I can just talk a little bit about it, is that if we look at the Dharma kind of as a V, with one arm of the Dharma that has to be strengthened, it has to be understood, and has to be worked with, is the side of self-acceptance, self-allowance, letting ourselves be, looking at our psychological turmoil and pain so that we can start undoing the knot of that inward angst. And much of Dharma, and many of the books that are written about Dharma really rest on that arm of the V. If you just picture it like that. And then we have many other books, many other teachers that emphasize the left arm of that V, and that's the side of emptiness. And to put too much emphasis on either side is to throw the whole thing off. Now, what happens if you put too much emphasis on the side of self-acceptance? Well, it will bring a lot of inward harmony. It will allow your life to be better lived, quieter. You'll be more at ease and at home in your body and mind. But that's very limited, or those markers of success really pale by comparison to the truth of where the Dharma is pointing. And although those may be very fulfilling, they're conditionally fulfilling. And they'll last, well, as long as the conditions last. Now, the other side of the V, the side of emptiness, the side of seeing the inherent emptiness of self, the truth of anatta, of non-self in Buddhism, is very appealing, or can be very appealing, to those who carry a tragic sense of me. Because there's nothing I would rather do than get over the tragic sense of me and run to my empty me, which my me is empty. But you can't do that. You have to go through the pain of what you believe about yourself in order to see the emptiness. So the side of self has to be acknowledged, and whatever understanding we have at the relationship of self has to be fully embraced, and we have to look, but we just keep asking questions and encouraging and enticing curiosity so that we continue to look further than resting on the conclusion of the sense of I. Now, if we rest on the side of emptiness, then we can cause an awful lot of harm. And there are traditions that do just that. Emptiness is makes a very poor philosophy of life, as I've mentioned before, because essentially you can do anything to anyone and it doesn't matter because it's all illusion, right? So where we're moving in Seattle Insight is at the vortex of those two arms. We don't rest on the right link, and we don't rest on the left link. We take it right there, right where they meet. And so in order, and so if we extend ourselves in either direction along that, we know what we're doing. And at some point, skillful means will move along those two different axes. But we know what we're doing. And the knowing what we're doing when we extend out and do practices that allow self-friendliness, or we extend out and do practices that invite an empty understanding of life. At the point where we rest is we come back to the vortex. We come back to this, to that which balances both. And so when I give a talk like this, we're extending a little bit out in terms of the sense of self. And I've intentionally looked at areas of self where many of us are caught, and maybe desperately so, like the sense of the controlling, the sense of control. And today, the sense of the shame, the shameful sense that many of us carry. Because I want us to understand that. I want us to come to a deep level of acceptance so that we can get a handle on being driven by this perpetual story of the underprivileged me. We have to arrest that. We have to put an end to that. This isn't a group therapy where we're all feeling this, you know, we're all congregating to moan and complain about the poor sense of I. This is a congregation of us putting an end to any kind of belief in I. And so it's at that, it's where those two legs meet. Is where we rest. You see, the resting point is not a philosophy. Either one of those arms are philosophical because they are intoned by thoughts and strategies. But in the middle, where those two arms meet, there is just stillness. There is an extension in one direction nor in the other. If there's something functional to do or you want to introduce yourself, you introduce yourself fully without claiming any emptiness within that delivery. And yet where that sense abides, where the awareness rests, is not contained within anything. There's an awful lot of exploration that we have to do to come to that vortex. And so let us understand why I am offering these distortions of mind. Not to encourage a psychological attitude to the Dharma, but to come to that sense of stillness by looking at those areas that in which we are deeply embedded in our pain. And certainly one of those is the area of shame. You know, as we begin to practice, I think you'll find that you have less defenses. You have less ability to excuse yourself, either internally or to others. That's one of the psychological crises that the Dharma throws our way, I think, is that it takes away our defenses. It starts stripping because we see it. We can't. If we could pretend we didn't see it, then we would be fine. We could continue to lie. And lying when you don't really see it isn't really lying. It's just hoping that you're different than what you might be. But when you see it and you know the value of the truth of the seeing, then when somebody asks you, did you do it? You want to say no. But it doesn't settle with you well to say no. Because there's a knowing truth, awareness, leaves the residual knowing. It's as if I just waved my hand in front of your face. Now you would know that the hand occurred. There wouldn't be, and then I said, no, I didn't do that. It wouldn't work. In the same way, when we see what we do, the hand is waved in front of our face. And there's no then reclaiming our innocence of not knowing. Now, remorse, which is not shame, is the willingness to acknowledge the knowing that you did something. And because you can also see the pain of what you did occurring after the activity occurred, you can't deny that either. And because the heart is innocently available, it also feels the weight of the pain that was caused. And very naturally, there is a kind of remorse. This remorse is not image. It's just the acknowledgement of pain and the owning of one's own mistake in the fact that that pain occurred. So let's not confuse shame with remorse. Remorse is healthy. It's healthy in relationship to an honest mind. I once worked in a school system as a school social worker, and I was young, but I met somebody in that school system, a student, that really shocked me. I remember feeling, after meeting him several times in counseling sessions, walking away and thinking, this person has no conscience. He will say anything at all, anything. There's no inward grouping at all. And therefore, he's ungovernable and will extend himself anywhere because he has no remorse. He had nothing. He had no feeling about what he was doing. It was the first time I'd ever encountered a sociopath and really saw up close and personal what that quality of mind was like. That's not what we're doing here. That's not what we're doing here. We're being honest. We're developing an honesty, a crispness that says, yeah, I did it. I did it. Okay, I did it. And is willing to take the repercussions of a mistake. And not willing to form a sense of image around that mistake, which is where shame comes in. So you see, I'll talk a little bit about guilt tonight as well. It seems to me that guilt is what is an emotional reaction to a sense of self-betrayal, really, around a mistake that we make sometime in our history. Now, why would I call that self-betrayal? I'll get to that in a moment. And shame is how we feel about ourselves as a person, irrespective of the events that have occurred. And guilt, if you have a number of guilty episodes in your life, then those build a residue of shame in how we hold ourselves and how we look upon ourselves. It's kind of a mistake. Have you felt that ever? That you're just a mistake waiting to happen? You wake up in the morning and the world is sort of stacked against you, or it feels as if. It's kind of like you're walking uphill all the time. So shame is not necessarily connected to action. Shame is what we acquire from how people treat us, and certainly how we treat ourselves. I was in a grocery store, and I was coming out to the parking lot, and there was about a 4 or 5 year old little girl, and the mother was taking the little girl by the shoulders and shaking the little girl rather violently and screaming at the top of her voice at how terrible she had been in the grocery store. And I thought, we're witnessing the installation of shame. Because the little girl doesn't know the difference between being scolded for her actions as opposed to being scolded for her being. And that was clearly the differential. The difference there was clearly not stated. So what the girl hears is that there's something wrong with me, not that there's something wrong with what I did. And over time, there's an accumulation of many such encounters with life. And we feel disadvantaged. We don't feel like we're on an equal playing field. And I remember the woman saying to the little girl as she was yelling at her, "Shame on you for acting that way. Shame on you." Now, I don't think there's much worse that we can offer somebody than that statement. Shame on you. Shame on you. Wishing the person shame. Because once we have established the posture of shame, and it's a posture, it's an assumption, it's a emotionally fed residue that carries a story of me. Then we're always trying to fill that hole, aren't we? We constantly want that hole filled, and we don't know how to do it. But the way we try to do it is to lean away from the hole. The hole. Remember the series on the shadow. Remember that when you lean away from a certain critical belief system, you're creating that belief system in your leaning. So once we start operating from the conviction that we are a shameful person, then the leaning will convince us, even though its intention is to counter that conviction, the leaning will in fact convince us that the conviction is true. Because there's nothing you can get over, there's nothing you can do to get over your self-belief. That can't be touched. And you think that somebody likes you, they're just not really seeing you who you really are. If they really saw who you were, they wouldn't like you in the same way you don't like yourself. So the phonier we are, the more pretentious we become, the more we think we're escaping the glare of our own incompetence. But we're not. Because inside there's a deep conviction that we're not worth knowing at all. And that builds year after year. I want us to feel this, so I'm making it a little bit dramatic. I want us to feel this thing. It's not a hopeless talk. I'm not going to leave you in the depths of your despair. We have to walk out of this thing as well as walk into it. But let's just walk into it, because many of us feel that. So we attempt to compensate for our shortcomings. One is that you'll often find a lot of defense, very defensive, because when somebody is pointing out something, then they're pointing to that rotten core that we feel. And so we have learned often to defend very successfully those thrusts. And so the quality of defensiveness. Another compensation for some is trying to be very agreeable, so that the real sense of me can't be seen. Or another one is perfectionism, so that we can correct the fault by making our outward display perfect. So that if somebody recognizes perfection in the activity, in the action, in the product, they won't question the imperfection that might be in the delivery system. And another quality of a person with shame is that they like things black and white. Ambiguity doesn't sit well. And a strong sense of rightness against wrongness. That allows them to couple their being to a set of principles that holds them steady in their adherence to those principles. And therefore they won't falter in the ambiguity of what real life is. So I hope each one of us is maybe just hearing a point that we can take for further investigation in ourselves. Now, I don't have to say too much about this because I think we are all very aware of it. But religions love to induce shame. One of the things I appreciate about Seattle the most is that there are fewer churches in this town than in any other large metropolitan area in this country. And I think it speaks well to our sanity. Because religions, and Buddhism included, if you've ever listened to the Jataka tales, which are the fairy tales, for lack of better words, about the Buddha in his former lifetimes, where he is doing actions that I suppose they're supposed to make us want to be that kind of person, but mostly I just got fed up with him because I wasn't anywhere close to the principle that was being espoused by that. Like, you know, he sees a starving lion. He's on a cliff and he sees a starving lion who's in a sort of a hole. So in order to save the starving lion from starving, he throws himself off the cliff so that the starving lion can eat him. If you want to feel shame, read the Jataka tales. Nobody can approach that. Why should we approach that? I don't think that's very self-aware, personally. Well, am I going to pay for this one, right? But that the sense of those stories of, I don't know, whoever our prophets are. And especially if I can just, because I've just seen it so often in Catholicism, that deep ingrained sense of shame that people are raised with on an ongoing basis. Partly do the confessional, that sense of confessing, where you can't deal with your own mistakes. You have to go through an intermediary. in order to work out your problem. As if making a mistake much more than its significant, its real significance. Mistakes are the way we feed, the way we learn. Trying to live a life free of mistakes is absurd. It's not the point of it. It's missing the entire point of life. One of the best instructions I ever got when I started teaching was from the teacher who was encouraging me to teach. He said, "Don't be afraid of making mistakes, Rodney. Just go out there and risk. And if you fall flat, then you'll hear about it." So that sense of needing forgiveness through someone else, and that kind of paranoia of having made a mistake and now having to go through this whole system, ritualistic system, in order to espouse myself and cleanse myself, absolution. Now, as monks, we had once a month we would meet in confession with one another. It's very different than the confession of church. What it did, which I appreciated, first of all, it was done in Pali, and I never knew what I was confessing. So I'd just be reading this thing off. You know, I don't know. I mean, but in my heart, I would be thinking about where transgressions had been. And since there were like 250 rules, you're transgressing everywhere. The point of those rules, of course, is just to lay the foundation of mindfulness throughout the day. But, you know, you forget and you do things. You take a bite of food standing up, that's a transgression. You know, it's that kind of thing. Anyway, so we would meet once a month, and we would just pick a partner, and we would go through this whole ritual. And what it did was it kept things fresh. It didn't feel like I would make anything. You know, nothing was secret. Nothing was kept hidden. And you're just saying, "Well, I did this, and I did this, and I did that, and I did the other." And they were saying the same thing, and it was kind of a refresher. It was a turning over of the soil. And it wasn't meant in any way to be ritualistic in the sense that hierarchical, where you're confessing, you know, to a whole hierarchical system so that God wasn't like that. You're just keeping your consciousness fresh. Letting the residue of your actions be known as you already knew them to be. You see, it's the knowing. We hide from the knowing. We know the knowing. And then we hide from that eye of the knowing. And we hide it sometimes through drugs and drink, because we can't stand that eye looking back at us. You see, we don't know how to work with forgiveness. We, as a society, don't know how to keep our consciousness clean and fresh and alive and participating. It's rolling over. It's like one of those lottery wheels that never stops. It's just the cards just, it's just rolling over. In that way, it was never felt to me shameful. It felt to me remorseful. I honor the fact that I did something, and maybe it was just a minor infraction and it wasn't anything but a mistake, or maybe I said something or did something to hurt someone. Okay, I'll take this moment and feel the pain of what we just did. Not to deny the pain. That's a historical fact. And you see, I think the first thing we have to do is to honor the I, the knowing, the looking, the EYE, not the I as an I, but iwai, the eye of knowing, that sense that we did something. Okay, let me just feel this. Let me honor the fact that this I said or did that. And you feel the pain of having done it. Okay, that's where we start looking away. That's where the compassion for ourselves is no longer there. We want to cover over that pain and move on with, and sort of dust it over, bury it somehow. So we repress it, which is the only way you can bury anything in the mind, is to pretend. And it doesn't do anything. It sits there and smolders. So it smolders, and it's this guilt, this sense, it keeps drawing us back because we're not finished with having recovered or with the compassion for ourselves. If we can remain open to the pain we have caused and not try to shield ourselves from that pain, just stay, okay, all right. Then, really, you start feeling you know what you feel? You feel you did the best you could. The best you could doesn't mean that you were aware and had all of the ingredients of a perfect moment. It means that in that moment, conditions being what they were, your moods being what they were, your attitude and whatever, anger or whatever, all of that is the given, and there wasn't enough awareness, and that was the fact. And then there was an ill-conceived action, and it caused pain, and all of that was the best we could do. You see, you have to get that point. Okay. Then, and you never deny, and you, so it keeps coming back, you know, so, okay, keeps coming back. And you just deal with it. Until the heart begins to release you from the grip of guilt. Through the willingness to stay attuned. Not to keep reaffirming how you weren't up to the task and how awful you were and all that, but to stay with the pain of what you did, the compassion feeds you back now. It says, okay, acknowledged, okay, now let's feed back. Feed you back. Lets you move on. Lets you learn from that. Now I can learn from it. Now I can move on. It doesn't keep me entrenched in a particular time in history when I wasn't up to the task, and 30 years from now I'm still dug in a stake at that point, tethered to that stake. It lets you move on. Okay, I wasn't. Okay, I can move on. You just feel it. You can just feel it. It's because I'm willing to look at the pain and to own it. Yep. Yes, that happened. I was working in a nursing home for a brief period of time, and I kept passing a room where this woman who was in coma, was in the room, and she would, every time I passed the room, no matter what time of day, an elderly woman would be in there damping her forehead and tending to her, and I knew that she didn't work there. So one day I just stopped in the room, and it turns out that she was the woman's mother. The woman was 33, and so I imagine the mother was probably in her 60s. In any case, as I got to know them a little bit, would step in, I asked them the story of how her daughter got into a coma. And she said that 33 years ago, or I guess she was 7 years old, so however many years that was, she said that she'd had an argument with her daughter. And it had been a rather ferocious argument and a lot of screaming. And her daughter went into her room. And the mother says, I'm not going to go in there and apologize. And then after a while, she knocked on the door. Nobody answered. The door was had some furniture. She pushed her way through, and the young woman, the young girl, had hung herself in her room. And she caught her daughter before her daughter had died, and took her down. And for these last however many years, well over 20 years, she had been in a coma. And I mean, you just feel that. You feel that. And suicide in itself is such a it's such a meaningful act, if I can just say that, because it leaves skeletons in everyone else's closet. And it's just, I know that it's not necessarily meant to be hurtful to others, but in fact it is a hurtful act to those who are left alive. Because everyone is thinking, well, what if I had, if I could, I wish I had seen, or whatever. And this mother was no different, and she had lived her whole life with this single point where her family had fallen apart long ago, her friends had all left her, and all she was going to do was to serve her daughter as a penance to having had that argument that led to the tragedy. And you see, although this is an extreme case, how these points of references in our life can have such a stigma, have such a focus for us, that in fact we do penance for them our entire life. Some of us never move on. As if we hadn't changed in multiple ways from the time we did those acts through all the learning that has taken place, even if it were a moment ago, to we're no longer the same person who did that act. And so what we're trying to forgive no longer even exists. The person no longer even exists. He or she has long since changed. But you see, it's a tact of the ego, egoic sense of me, to hold you in place, to keep you permanently repressed and suppressed. And we buy right into it because we believe ourselves to be shameful, and this confirms the image that we have lived with. And so if we live with shame, then we are going to imbue many of our actions with guilt, because that reconfirms the image that we know of ourselves. So what's the payoff of all this, you see? I want to cut to the chase. Let me see this thing. What do I get out of this thing? You know what you get? You get hard work. You get meaning. And you get the psychodramatic drama of it all. And we love, you know, it's like, oh, we're in the trenches here. To the point where sometimes we will feel that whatever pain or impositions are placed upon us are deserved, because that's just part of the penance of having such a life that we have lived, such a despicable life. In hospice care, it was not infrequent that we would come upon people who would refuse to take their pain medication because they're obviously in pain. You could tell in face and figure that they're clenched. But they refuse. And when you started to talk to them a little bit and see what was going on, there had been so much shame in their life that they felt that the pain at the end of their life, they were atoning for that shame. This is how tragic it can become. It confirms where we are in life, doesn't it? you know, if 30 years ago I did something that I can never, you know, it's confirming somehow. That all the, yes, I've been here, and no, I didn't make a good imprint, but I made a imprint. You see how tenacious the sense of I builds upon itself to stake a claim on itself, to take a posture for it to be known. For it to be known. May I say that a person is a verb, not a noun. Each of us in this room is a verb. We are not a thing. We are not an entity. We are a verb. We're in movement. In fact, the full realization of that is what awakening is. We're afraid more than the pain of continuing the history of our shame, the pain of that. We're more afraid of being a verb. What would it mean if we released ourselves from the need to self-condemn? What would it mean if we stood up and got sick and tired of the pain, the self-imposed, the self-inflicted pain of our life, in which shame, although engendered early on, has been reconditioned every moment? Not through an outside source, but through our own self-attitude. What if we got tired of that? What if we saw it and was aware that shame was present in this moment? And would say, okay, look at this story. Look at this ridiculous story I have been telling myself so that I can stay within the shell of shame. Let me question this story. Let me look at it. Let me hold the emotion without reconditioning in the story. Let me feel the shame. This is what it means to wake up. To be undeterred by anything. To look at the residual qualities that we have assumed, the deepest assumptions of our own personal history, of our own sense of temperament and character. And what we find that is the lasso that keeps us tied to it is the replay of the story over and over again, and the reconfiguration of perception with that story, so that we're not seeing the truth of what's occurring, we're seeing through the story. And so the perception is distorted by the very story. And so we never really see. So I say to myself, I'm not going to do that anymore. I have a higher respect for myself. And I have a higher respect for myself than wanting to jump off the cliff and give my body to a lion. Work with this emotion. This emotion is nothing. It's the story that holds the intimidation and the fear and the angst But how with that? That's the past. I don't care about that now. Let me move on. I'm putting that aside. It's over. Chapter closed. Book finished. Now, new book. Let me move with this now. Now I'm not going to claim any reference whatsoever. Not going to write a new chapter story. I'll learn all along the way from my mistakes. Mistakes are part of it. Mistakes are the learning, the art of living is in the translation of the fall. Is in the interpretation of the fall. That's the art of living. I can do that. Now we reclaim our own self-forgiveness. Now we reclaim our birthright as a verb. Now we reclaim our heart because we've learned, I can, pain, okay, fine. I know that my heart is at stake here. If I turn away from it, it will be closed down. So even in the pain that I have engendered, I have to keep my heart open to it. And therefore I will move and learn and grow. And as difficult as it is, I know to keep my eyes open. I know that above all else. And we put an end to shame. We put an end to guilt. Through the grace of our own heart. And it's that close. Not through 300 sessions of psychoanalysis. It's just knowing the right direction. It's just knowing the right way to the right way to do this thing. I don't need to go to confessional anymore. And by the look of things, maybe the priest should come to confessionals. And I put an end to it. I put it down. And may we all do so. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if there are any questions or comments about anything, we'll have a few minutes here. Yes.
As you were talking, it occurred to me that probably the worst kind of, the most heavy sense of shame I've ever experienced was not, and it started at a very, very early age, and I think this is probably pretty common, it was not about anything I did, but about having feelings that I was not supposed to have.
Yes.
Yes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
She says the worst feeling of shame she can remember was when she was younger and had feelings, not things that actions that she did, but feelings that she wasn't supposed to have. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that you're not supposed to have them for shame to occur, whether it's actions of body, speech, or mind. And feelings contain enormous amount of shame for us because we have been raised, often puritanically, that there isn't supposed to be feelings of, say, sexual arousal or, I don't know, I mean, anything, anger or fear or any. So we make more out of them. And the making more out of them, they're actually given exaggerated significance. And then, of course, when they're exaggeratedly significant, we get more fearful of them. And we feel caught in the loop of our identification with them. And then we act them out, or can act them out, in very unskillful ways. Why? Because we are unwilling to feel them in the first place. So let us say that all of us, as human beings, have the entire range of what it means to be human within our consciousness. We're not individually different. We have different, because of our conditioning in the past, different amounts come up more frequently for some than for others. But all of us contain the entire range. Mother Teresa had lust sometimes. All right? Can we put that? Hang up Mother Teresa in your bedroom and put lust lover. Because obviously she did, or she wouldn't have come to such wholeness. She loved it. She equated it somehow. She must have. Or would have driven her insane. Every facet of a human being comes through consciousness. Let us deal with that. We're not going to escape anything. So let's just make it what it is. It's just another facet of being a human being. Let's just look at it in that light. Rather than making anything significant whatsoever. I don't care what our parents told us about this or don't do that. Just look at it. Now from the looking, from the willingness to have a relationship with it, we won't charge it. We won't give it any more charge than it's deserving. And we won't be afraid of it, which is where our identification gets hooked into it. And we can just deal with it as an emotional feeling that we have. Doesn't mean we have to act it out at all. And as long as we're not doing any harm, which means to ourselves and to others, there's just one precept in Buddhism. Do no harm to yourself or others. Just don't do any harm. That becomes more subtle as to how that impinges upon us, but then we can try things. I'm not harming. There's nobody harmed here. There's nobody. You look and you really look to see. Then it's been within all of that, you have a large range to explore and investigate and with curiosity and interest, rather than to feel betrayed because you have this feeling or that feeling. The art of living is the art of exploring and dancing and feeling these things and opening to them. It's so common sense, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking really. This is 101. It really is. It's common sense 101. But probably we passed it by long ago. We thought it was, I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. But suddenly it all got very funny, you know, when people started frowning at us. Yes.
I think that the thing that sticks with me more than a sense of shame is regret. The things not having not done are things
right.
That I have done.
A sense of regret. Well, I don't hear, I mean, that to me is guilt. And so, I mean, guilt contains a wide spectrum of different ways we can frame it. But basically, you hold yourself in contempt for not having lived up to what you think you should have done at that moment. Right? Is there any doubt that if that situation occurred now, that you would act differently? No, she said for the tape. Then what are you forgiving? You've already changed. You've already moved on. You've already healed to it, really. That's the most you can do in this life. Pull up the stake now. Move on. It's time to go on now. New chapter. Now when you think about it, honor the pain that you of what you didn't do, the regret of what you didn't do, or the mother you ever were, or whatever. Feel that. And then feel, at the same time you hold that old image, now grow, now come back. It's like you have 1,000 images. That's the one that happened 50 years ago. Now just bring that image frame by frame right up until this moment, and now feel yourself in the frame of who you are now, and all of a sudden, throw that deck out. You're healed. Do you see what I'm saying? That frame will never let you be anything other than what you were. It's in history. You can read about it. It will never, ever let you out of its fixed response. It's over. But long since you have grown. So that's it.
I also realized while you were talking tonight that I have made in my mind the impact of those things that I have done or not done much greater.
There you go.
Than
yes.
They really were.
She's made them much greater than they really were. Because the mind, when it has the idea of shame as its basis for its identity, will overemphasize that which it can claim as part of itself. You see, those things certify your image. And so they're going to be out of proportion. Probably out of proportion to everyone who is even in the scene at that moment. Mom, are you still thinking about that? Can't believe you're still thinking about that. That's all long gone, long ago. You see? This is about renewal. If you were an entity, you would be stuck. That'll be it. I'd just say, well, you might as well just go out, and yeah, that's it. Just throw yourself in front of a car. But because you're a verb, because you're a verb, because you can be renewed, because you're a renewable resource, perhaps the only one we have on this planet, you are a forever renewable. Now, where can anything stick? Don't let the imaging and the emotions associated with the imaging fix you anymore. Be willing to feel the emotion, feel the old image, and bring yourself current, and then move on. Am I sounding like Dr. Phil? Yes. Yes.
And go, oh, it's that story again, and I'm going to feel my pain. Except that I don't really know what I'm feeling. I just know it's not good. You know, it's like you can't sort through all the layers. How do you know?
Be patient with it. The question is that the feelings you have are ambiguous and multi feelings, and there are lots of different reasons that you did what you did, and all of that, right? And some sense of protection or defensiveness or some skillful, you know, all of it gets kind of enmeshed in there. So just be gentle with it. Let it play across. Don't try to overemphasize any aspect of it. Don't try to bring forth and star your role in it and diminish it. Just be gentle with it as a memory and the emotions associated with it. And watch how your story does keep going back to replay itself over there so that it can somehow feel justification for having to feel it at all. And the only way it can justify having to feel it at all is to go back and to rearrange the story so that it puts you in a more prominent role or in, you know, is being thrashed in a way you never were or something. Don't do any of that. Just let it float in the mind. Feel whatever it is to feel. It doesn't matter. Because any story, whether it's righteous or sinister, is the same thing. It has nothing at all to do with you in this moment. Nothing. There isn't even a connecting point between who you were and who you are. There's no connecting point. You know that? There's nothing that connects you. Nothing. In reality. So why do you connect it? In this moment, you are undefinable. Period. And everything that tries to is the wrong dimension to look. End of story. Yes.
I can sort of grasp this in a spot where you're being mindful of shame that you've suffered in your life or whatever. But it seems like usually it, within day-to-day life, it comes up not when you're thinking about what that was, but it's when something pushes a button that triggers it without your awareness. And 2 weeks later, you find that you realize something about it. But at that moment, it's a reactive element that's there. And how do you deal with that?
Question is that, you know, in the course of living, these things come up throughout the day, and it may be weeks before you have this kind of residual pain that circumstances brought forth, and you have long since saw the arising of that, and you just as it starts showing itself over the days, you're suddenly held within its power. Or something. It doesn't make any difference when you wake up. It doesn't. You don't have to catch it at the first, the first frame. It doesn't make any difference. Wherever you catch it, stop, and go to the emotion. And this can be felt, just for itself. Feel it just for itself. Feel the shame just as itself. It's not me, a shameful me. It's not shaming about something. It is just an emotion, just for itself. It has no other significance than its feeling quality. I can feel that. Don't let it throw you off by assuming the story that is it. Because you see, it's the problem is with the emotion. The story is trying to justify why you have to feel the emotion. So you go to the story to try to work out why it is that you have to feel what you're feeling. That does nothing to the feeling. The only way to do something with the feeling is to feel it. And that allows it to move rather than to be stuck in as a kind of earmark on a page. So whenever you're feeling it, sit down with it if you have a few minutes. Bring your mindfulness to bear upon that in that moment. Fair enough? Okay, good. So that's all we have time for this evening. Thank you.